This is Reese Brady, dictating field report number 16, the Pilgrim File. Rental doesn't handle as well as my Julia. Always thought that the new BMWs lack real road feel. They try to compensate with additional weight in the steering, which isn't the same thing at all. But the insurance company assures me that I shouldn't be stuck with this thing for more than a few more days. Noticed a reference to Mr. Benjamin Amherst's private research consortium while I was in the emergency room. First thought, there is no chance that's the Amherst I know. Second thought, there is every chance that Nash met that Amherst. You'd think endangering national security was his job, rather than vagrancy and being a failed novelist. It would be an unforgivable oversight to neglect investigating this connection further. I can think of exactly 5 American citizens who might want the package more than Mr. Amherst would have. And I work for 4 of them.
My stepdad could own a private island if he wanted, but he's still here in our musty old house. If I went upstairs to where the bedrooms are, mine would probably still be exactly as I left it all those years ago. We were together in the gloomy old parlor with the huge fireplace and cobweb-covered waterfall chandelier. He had just paid my bail, and I had driven over once I'd gotten out. Thanks would have been in order, but I skipped that and went straight to asking him why exactly he'd done that. My stepfather was a faded version of the man I had last seen 18 years ago. The oxygen tank and wheelchair had practically become part of his anatomy. "Ben, why would you do that?" I asked. "I mean, you've been watching the news, right? Reading the papers? You know what it is I've been accused of. It's all over the radio."
"Accused, you say?"
Ben replied between puffs on his oxygen mask. "Yes, Ben, accused," I replied rather shortly. Then I asked, "Ben, why am I here?"
"You were always a total disappointment to me," Ben said. "I loved your mother, and I wanted to be a father to you. But you refused everything I taught you. You're a fabricator, a flimflam artist. And yes, I've been reading the news. It looks like things have finally caught up with you."
I turned to leave.
"Don't!" Ben shouted loudly enough to startle me. Then he started coughing. "Don't, Larry," he said, more calmly this time after the coughing stopped. "Wait, hear me out."
"Why should I, Ben?" I asked, hand on the doorknob.
"Money," he answered. "Considerable amounts, if you just do something for me."
This made me turn around. "You must have 1 million employees," I said. "Pay one of your cronies."
"No," Ben said in a hoarse voice. "This is too important. I need someone I can trust."
I feigned doubling over with laughter. "You just got done saying..."
"I know what I just said,"
Ben rasped, then took another hit of the oxygen.
"There's trust, and then there's trust. I don't trust anyone to be trustworthy. But I trust you to always be ruled by your laziness, myopathy, and greed."
"Ben, I don't have to take any of this from you, you know?"
"Name a price," Ben said. "Think of what it will cost to actually get you out of every mess you've put yourself in. Then double it. That is what I will pay you for 1 hour of your time in this house.
This gave me pause. What do you want me to do, Ben? I inquired.
You know what it is I do, don't you? Ben asked. You know what my company does?
Sure I do, Ben. Biochemical, biomedical, something or other.
All my life,
Ben said, but speaking like he was speaking to someone in the corner now instead of to me.
All of my one single wretched life. All I have tried to do is render one positive change to the underlying equations that govern this woeful, gray world.
Haven't you done that? I asked. I mean, aren't you a...
What the hell good does all that money do for me? Ben said. I can't even breathe properly.
I tried to come up with an answer, while Ben took more drags on his oxygen, but couldn't think of any way to respond.
There's been a side project, Ben continued, that I have kept quiet about and funded for the last 20 years. Only my two most trusted people ever worked on it with me. They both died. Suddenly. Unfortunately. But their great work was complete before that happened. Now I can finally see the fruition of what I started.
Died? I asked. How did they die? Ben did not answer me.
We will never truly understand what electricity is, Ben said. Yet we have hijacked its outward manifestations quite successfully over the last 70 years or so. We will never truly understand the atom. Yet we have harnessed certain aspects of it for weaponry and for creating electrical power. Likewise, we will never really know or understand biology. Not at its most root levels. Yet we can study it. And I have spent a lifetime studying what happens when things go wrong and biology breaks. I have gained much insight from that.
What kind of insight? I asked. Ben became aware of my presence again, looked up, and locked eyes with me.
Indefinite, repeatable youth, he said flatly. A way to reverse the aging process. Effect a full reset of biochronological states.
What? I asked, stunned. How? Ben held eye contact and said,
with vampirism. You have to induce vampirism, and then you have to reverse it. That's how this works.
Okay, Ben, I said. Thanks for your time. All the best. I'm going to go now.
Now wait just 1 second, Ben said harshly. I'm the one that spent a lifetime studying this stuff. Certainly you can hear me out.
Okay, Ben, go ahead. What in the world is this thing that you're talking about?
Everything about us, said Ben. About humans as an organism, including our beginnings at one point, our functioning over time, and then our dying. All of it is driven by an underlying biochronology, a biological clock that is deeply tied to the laws of the physical universe. Human biochronology, Ben said, is like an hourglass that has been bolted into position once created. It can never be flipped back over and restarted again. There are no mechanisms for returning it to an earlier, more youthful state. Vampirism shatters the hourglass, utterly obliterates it.
I was too stunned at what I was hearing to protest or interject. So Ben continued,
I have found a way to subsequently reverse vampirism, Ben said, his eyes gleaming a bit. I essentially can rebuild the hourglass after it has been shattered. And the astounding thing about this, that when you do that, you can set the chronology to any period in the person's biological history you want.
I said nothing.
You think I'm out of my tree, don't you?
He asked. Ben, absolutely, I replied, turning away from him again and reaching for the door. I believe that you're completely bonkers. Either that, or you're getting some kind of kick out of toying with me. Goodbye.
Well, the money's real, he said.
My hand froze on the doorknob.
The money is real, he repeated. Even if I am just a delusional old man having one last chuckle before I die, the money is very real.
I turned back around and faced him again. What do you want, Ben? Ben beckoned me closer. I sighed and stepped over to his wheelchair. He grunted slightly as he fished into the left pocket of his robe. He smelled bad. He looked like he had neglected to shave for several days. After some effort, Ben managed to retrieve what was in his pocket. He held out a small envelope, like the kind they put the cash in for you at the bank. I took it from him.
Careful, Ben said. Absolutely do not drop what is in there.
I gently tipped the little envelope so that its contents rolled out into my hand. It was 3 capsule pills. They were of an unearthly green hue.
Now, put those back carefully, he said, and put it in your pocket.
What are they for? I asked.
They contain the elixir that reverses vampirism and resets the chronobiology back to certain stages.
I'm not a vampire, I said.
Of course you're not a vampire, Ben hissed. You are the bait.
I'm the what? I asked.
You are to swallow those pills, but not until I tell you to, or this will all go very wrong, Ben explained. After swallowing them, you will give them a minute to dissolve so that the elixir can get into your bloodstream. That is the most critical step in the process. The elixir's molecularity must adhere to the bait's own blood chemistry, Ben said. And then you let the vampire bite you.
You can't be serious, I said. Ignoring my comment, Ben continued.
When the vampire drinks your blood, its chronology gets restored. It is rendered a full and complete reset. It will become human again. It will become human again. And it will do so at whatever biological state I want it to be.
I started laughing, genuinely laughing. This was comically absurd, and it had become too much for me. Ben, what the actual hell are you talking about? Ben exclaimed wordlessly in frustration,
tossing up his hands and then gripping the arms of the wheelchair. For the first time, I saw that the man before me was not Ben the Powerful, who I had grown up under, but an exhausted and discouraged old man who was sick, run down, and stuck in a wheelchair. "Stop thinking," he growled at me. "If you want the damn money, stop thinking. Your thinking is absolutely no good to anybody. Stop it."
"Okay, Ben, calm down. Just tell me what you want me to do."
"Look," he said, "when the vampire attacks a victim for the very first time, they never bite at the neck. You won't be bitten directly on the neck the first time. That is for the end, when they want to finish off their victim completely. The first couple of times, however, the vampire always just takes blood from the ankle or the wrist, the way a cat will toy with a wounded mouse before striking a final death blow. They just need to feed on you a bit. This'll be your first encounter with the vampire. She'll just bite your wrist, probably. You'll be fine. You will have taken the pills already. The elixir will be coursing through your bloodstream. And that's what leads to a reset.
You want me to take these crazy pills and then let some wacko come and bite me? I asked. Ben rubbed his pale, sunken face with emaciated hands. Then he looked up at me.
"You want the money?"
I let out another long sigh. "Okay, Ben," I said. "Where is this person? You said it was a she. Is she here in this house?" Ben turned away from me and looked at the hallway. Across the hallway from the wide entry of the parlor, the ancient wallpaper was interrupted by a narrow door that led down to a flight of stairs.
"I've got her in the basement," Ben said.
I was completely aghast.
"Damn it, Ben," I yelled. "I'm already facing charges, and you tell me you've got some woman locked up in your basement?"
Ben's hands came up, pleading, placating.
"Stop. Just stop, Larry. You don't have any true idea what's going on here," he said. "Like hell I don't," I spat back. "It's not as hard as you think it is to figure you out, Ben. You think you're so rich you can do anything you want, and now you've got a lady locked up in your basement?"
He insisted to me that that was absolutely not true.
"Oh, okay," I yelled. "So, if you don't have her tied up or something, call her up here, Ben. Call her up here right now so I can see her."
Then Ben said,
1878.
I stopped yelling. Now what in the world was he talking about?
1878, Larry, Ben said. She was born in 1878.
The lady you got locked up downstairs, born in 1878? That's just over 100 years ago. How's that possible?
She served as a volunteer nurse. International Brigades. Fascist Spain. 1937, Ben said. She was 59 years old at the time.
What? Who? The lady who got locked up in the basement?
Indeed, Ben replied.
There was not a hint of falsehood in his voice.
She was turned during that war in Spain. She fell very ill and was sent home on a hospital ship, when the doctors in Spain could do nothing more for her. They thought, perhaps, she had contracted asymptomatic bubonic plague. She was on that boat while she suffered through the conversion process, while her biochronology slowly fell to pieces. The medical staff treating her on the boat expected her to die. They certainly did not expect her to get up and start moving around again. But as soon as the ship made port in Boston, she disappeared. "What are you telling me, Ben?" I asked. "I had her tracked down," Ben replied. "It cost me millions. 18 people died in the process."
18 people? Who killed 18 people? Ben rotated one hand down and then extended an index finger towards the floorboards.
"This," I said, "is insane. Ben, I'm leaving." "I'll let her out," Ben exclaimed. "I'll let her out right now. How's that sound to you?"
"Guess, Ben," I replied. "If you've got someone locked up anywhere in this house, you need to let them go absolutely right now."
"Okay," Ben said, lowering his hands. "Okay. We're getting somewhere." Then he said, "In a minute, I am going to tell you to take two of the pills you have in your pocket. You must take only two of them. All three will be too many. Then you come down into the basement with me, and I'll let her out. But only take two of the pills. If you take all three of the pills and she bites you, it will reset her too far back. She wouldn't be viable outside of a womb."
I hesitated, but then Ben turned his chair in the direction of the hallway.
"Larry, let's go," he said. "Come on, you're about to make a lot of..."
Ben grimaced, burped, grabbed his stomach, groaned loudly, and lurched forward in his wheelchair.
"Ben!"
I cried and ran over to him. My stepfather was clammy to the touch. He had stopped breathing. Cursing and praying, I ran into the small servants' kitchen just off the parlor. There was a rotary phone on the wall in there. As quickly as I could, I called for an ambulance. A few hours later, I was standing by Ben's hospital bed. The old man's body was lifeless, deflated, under a sheet. Naturally, I did feel bad for him. He had become a rich man during his life, but the rest of his story was a sad one. He had been devoted to my mother, but my alcoholic mother had been a total monster towards him during their entire marriage. And he just put up with it, took it silently. I would have left. Hell, I did leave. I stole one of Ben's cars one night when I was 17, and I left. Ben's foot moved. I saw the summit of his big toe rotate towards me under the sheet. I stood frozen, petrified, and waited for that foot to move again. A growl started coming out of Ben. The growl was so low and the cadence so slow that it sounded almost like a gurgle. It made my skin crawl to listen to it. I wanted to turn and flee, but I could not move. One of the nurses padded in through the door next to me. I remained transfixed, staring at the body beneath the sheet. The nurse came up to me and said, "I'm so sorry for your loss, Mr. Amherst." I could barely respond. I only managed a whispery squeak. "It's a Gemian. My stepdad is Mr. Amherst." "Oh," she replied, "I'm so sorry, Mr. Gemian." "Hey," I whispered to her without turning my head. "Hey." "Yes, Mr. Ajemian?" the nurse asked. "His foot moved," I managed to hiss out of the corner of my mouth. "Oh, Mr. Ajemian, oh, you poor man, I am so sorry." She walked around to the other side of Ben's bed and checked the monitor. "I'm so sorry, Mr. Ajemian," she said. "That it's not what you think.
Involuntary muscle spasms happen all the time this soon after someone passes away. No, I'm so sorry. It doesn't mean anything.
Okay, I said, breathing a gigantic sigh of relief. Sorry. Thanks.
The nurse assured me that if there was anything she could do, she would be right outside at the nurse's station. She told me to take as much time as I needed. The nurse hustled out of the room to attend to other patients. I stood there next to the body, just breathing for a few minutes, trying to regain my composure. Then that growl started up again. Perplexed, I leaned forward, very slowly, and with one hand I gingerly lifted Ben's upper lip away from his teeth. Ben's canines were several millimeters longer than they had been earlier in the day. Of that, I am absolutely certain. I snatched my hand away. Perhaps I was in a fugue state after what I had just seen and heard. I wandered out of the hospital room like a zombie into the hallway. An orderly accidentally struck my shoe with a laundry cart, and that helped snap me back into reality. The orderly apologized profusely, but I was not listening. I was gazing intently over at the nurse's station. A state trooper in full uniform was speaking to one of the nurses. I recognized him as one of the officers involved in the case against me. This was not someone I wanted to run into right now. So I turned away and quickly took a circuitous route through the hospital ward until I came upon an elevator lobby. I made it to my car and drove out of the hospital parking lot. I stopped at a discount grocery store and picked up a six-pack of beer. I drank most of it while I drove back to Ben's old house. I knew there was not going to be much time. Pretty soon, someone from Ben's company would get word of what happened, and they would send their own people to the house. I parked my car behind the back of the house and went in through the front door I'd left unlocked when I went to the hospital following the ambulance that had taken Ben away. Nobody was there at the house yet. First, I went to Ben's study on the top floor. I rifled through every drawer and cabinet that was not locked. I did the same with all the bedrooms. My efforts were met with mixed results. There was no cash anywhere that I could find. There were no scraps of paper with safe combinations or bank account numbers written on them. But I did find a loaded handgun, a Colt Diamondback. I figured it might be worth a couple $100s if I could find the right person to fence it. When I went downstairs, I meant to continue my search for cash or any other valuables. But for some odd reason, I felt compelled to walk into the hallway that led past the parlor. I found myself standing in front of a little door that led down into the basement. Without thinking, I opened the door. It was like opening the entrance to a tomb. Cold, stale air swept past me, and I was staring into a complete void. I reached around, just inside the stairway door, and fumbled for the light switch. When I found it and flipped it, a single bulb mounted in the ceiling halfway down the basement stairs began to cast a weak, sickly yellow glow. I could not keep from standing on the first step at the top of the basement stairs and looking down into the darkness below. I took another step down and then another. Without really knowing why, I continued all the way down to the bottom. All I saw at first was the hot water heater and a couple of antique chairs. I turned to go, and I heard a woman's voice call my name.
Mr. Ajemian, sir?
The voice was so clear, it was like the person was standing right beside me. The voice quavered slightly, yet remained very articulate. I held still. I was not sure if I was hearing things or if the voice was real. It spoke again, still formal, the way my stepfather would speak to me, but worse.
Mr. Agemian, please, I need your help.
Who's there? I called out.
I am trapped behind the wall,
the person said.
Mr. Agemian, please, if you would go around behind the boiler.
I dared to take a few steps, just enough so that I could peek around the water heater. I saw a large, industrial-sized screwjack bolted to the floor. Its shaft was attached to a spot on the far wall.
Please, Mr. Agemian,
the voice spoke out to me.
Mr. Amherst has trapped me behind the wall. There's a secret door in the wall, and you have to turn the screw to open it.
I hesitated for a second, not sure what to do. Somewhere deep in my brain, there was a little voice telling me to run the hell out of there and never come back. But the more logical part of my brain was telling me that there was a person trapped behind the wall who would be in real danger if I failed to help them. Okay, okay, I cried, and ran over to the screwjack. I put both hands on its wheel. Hey, I said as I strained to turn the wheel. Hey, I just want you to know that I had nothing to do with this, you understand?
Oh, I do understand, Mr. Agemian,
the voice assured me, and she really did sound understanding.
Mr. Amherst trapped me in here. Please, please let me out. I've been stuck in here for days.
I haven't talked to that man in years, I shouted out so that the person trapped behind the wall could hear me. I had no idea he was doing any of this.
You are a good man,
the voice assured me in a sweet tone that made every effort to calm my fears. As I turned the wheel on the screwjack, there came from the wall an audible scraping sound as the shaft rotated and an 8-foot section of masonry started to be pulled away from the rest of the wall. It must have been a foot thick. The woman called out,
"Please hurry! I've been trapped in here for so long. I am so, so hungry."
For some strange reason, those words gave me pause. I stepped away from the wheel of the screwjack and walked up to the block of masonry that was, so far, pulled out of the wall only a few inches. I put my ear up against the cold concrete and tentatively ran my fingertips along the edge of the massive door. You're not going to hurt me, are you? I asked.
Oh, dear me, no, the voice responded. I harbor no ill will towards you at all. I just want to be released from this prison.
I returned to the wheel and continued cranking the door open.
I haven't taken a sip nor nip of food in, gosh, I don't know how long,
she was saying as I labored to get the door further and further open. There was a loud pop as the last of the massive door cleared the edge of the portal it was seated in. The doorway was now open just a couple of inches. Something moved at the edge of my vision. I looked up at the door and froze. What looked like the black, quivering tips of four giant spider legs were emerging at about shoulder height from behind the massive door. I squeezed my eyes shut, shook my head violently, and opened them again. A hand had now appeared from around the edge of the door, from the bony wrist to the ebony fingers to the tips of the blackened, rotted fingernails. The hand was freakishly long.
Keep turning that wheel, said the high, sweet voice in a supplicating tone.
I was suddenly covered in cold sweat. I let go of the wheel and stumbled backwards.
Keep turning, said the voice again.
It was lower in pitch this time. At that moment, I decided to get up the basement stairs as fast as I could and get out of the house.
Keep turning, miserable chattel!
The voice thundered and roared like how flames sound when they are swallowing a building. I ran. As I took the stairs, I heard a grisly, ripping sound like the tearing of cloth and flesh coming from the partly open door. As I charged up the stairs, I could tell I was being pursued. There was the sound of hungry panting as whatever it was that was chasing me closed swiftly from behind. The panting sounded almost human, but the clicking and clattering coming up behind me sounded like the footfall of a gigantic spider. Not able to bring myself to look back, I put everything into reaching the top of the stairs. It caught up with me and overcame me. It was not taking the stairs step by step like I was. It was running along the ceiling over my head. It leapt down in front of me, crashing onto the hallway floor, blocking my exit as I reached the top of the stairs. I closed my eyes. I absolutely did not want to see it. There was no sound, just my desperate and ragged heaving, and its avid and hungry panting, inches from my face. It waited. It wanted me to look at it. It knew I was not going anywhere, so it waited. Finally, I dared to open my eyes. The face that stared back at me through tattered locks of iron gray hair looked like the face of one of the damned, pulled straight from hell. The skin was cracked and blackened, like rolls of papyrus from a pharaoh's tomb. The eyes were drops of poisonous yellow with frigid white pupils. The expression on that face was one of sick, wicked amusement and a diabolical desire. Everything went black and I started to tip backwards. A hand with fingers as hard as cement grabbed the cloth of the front of my coat and shirt with a grip that ripped several of my chest hairs loose with it. The pain brought me back to consciousness.
"Oopsie," the voice said.
It was back to using the high, sweet voice again.
"Can't lose you like that just yet."
I remember forcing my gaze down, away from that face, at the print on its torn dress, and glimpses of ancient and fetid skin on the knees and legs beneath it. The feet were grisly, puffy, and malformed. There were what looked like long, thin tentacles, black and pointed at the tips, protruding here and there from the beast's feet and ankles.
"Look upon me! Aren't I beautiful?"
its creaking voice crackled at me. I could do nothing but squeeze my eyes shut. The abomination flung me like a limp toy across the hallway and into the parlor. I landed on the hearth of the old fireplace, falling heavily in a heap and groaning in pain from the impact. This elicited a mirthless, chittering laugh from the fiend. I saw its ghastly, translucent bare feet begin to step over the toppled furniture towards me. Terror-stricken, I managed to fish out the Colt, emboldened once it was in my hand. I got partially up and aimed it at the abomination. "Get back," I yelled. "I'll shoot you." My attacker's eyes flickered with amusement. It did not even pause. The monster kept walking towards me across the Abyssin rug, leathery lips parting in a cynical grin, displaying long, yellow teeth. I fired two shots into its chest, then I fired two more into its stomach. None of this had any effect. The diabolical smile got broader, showing even more sharp teeth. "It's a zombie," my terror-addled brain thought. Gotta go for the head.
I breathed, aimed, and fired my fifth shot. It hit home, right between the damned thing's eyes. This caused its head and upper body to rock backwards violently from the force of the 38 slug's impact. But then, the gruesome head counterbalanced and whipped back towards me. In an instant, my hand, gun and all, was being crushed in the gnarled hand of the monster. The pain that shot all the way up to my shoulder was tectonic. I shrieked, although I knew perfectly well the isolation of my stepfather's house made that a futile act. I tried with my other hand to wrestle free, but I might as well have been wrestling with a grinning, demented marble statue. To my horror, I saw the bullet hole in its forehead seal shut in a matter of seconds.
"Fun, fun, fun, that's the cat's pajamas,"
the abomination croaked, then shook the gun loose and bit off my right index finger. I howled in shock and pain and collapsed back onto the floor, clutching my mauled hand to my chest. The malevolent aberration stood over me, with its head tilted back. It was holding my severed finger above its ghastly, cadaverous lips. It let out a long, moaning sigh of relief as it sucked the blood from the detached finger. With my good hand, I took the chance to grab the envelope Ben had given me, and I quickly swallowed all three pills. There was a loud, sudden click in the air above me, and the creature was staring down at me.
"Chattel," it said to me. "Oh, sneaky, conniving chattel. What are you up to?"
As fast as I could blink, it was sitting on my stomach with one hand pressing on my chest. The damn thing was the size of a small woman, but I felt like a car was on top of me.
"Spit," it commanded, striking me across the face with its free hand. "It."
It struck me backhanded this time.
"Out."
The demonic brute went as if to strike me a third time, but I convulsed. One bright green pill appeared protruding from between my lips.
"Ah,"
the fiend said, plucking up the pill with its sepulchrous fingers.
"What's this you were doing? Trying to abbreviate your suffering with poison? Trying to escape me again, are you?"
With the tip of its withered beaked nose, it sniffed at the pill. Then it shrugged nonchalantly and tossed the pill away into a corner. Before I even saw it move again, my neck was being crushed and torn in its jaws. I could feel my own blood spatter out all over my shirt, my neck, and my chin. It was getting all over the face and chest of the monster above me, which giggled and burped even as it held me clamped in its jaws, sucking out my blood in great gobs. Then the beast suddenly released me. Still straddling me, it sat bolt upright. Its gore-soaked jaw was quivering. It let out a terrible shriek and then a tremendous vomiting groan. It started whipping its hair and arms above its head in a superhuman frenzy. I could hear the bones crack in its neck, arms, and jaw from the deranged force it put into doing this. The thing sprang off of me, landed supine on the floor, and went rigid like someone having a seizure. Then it rolled over onto its hands and knees, screaming and wailing. It started crawling around in a circle on all fours, like a burn victim maddened from the pain. Black goo pooled up in its eyes and dripped in thick, shiny stringlets onto the floor. With my good hand, I grabbed the wound on the side of my neck in an attempt to staunch the bleeding. Finally,
all of its motion ceased. The fiend was sitting on its shins with its back to me. Its matted hair was plastered between delicate-looking shoulder blades. I lay there, too scared to move or make a sound. Suddenly, it leapt to its feet, took a running leap at the door at the end of the parlor that led into the small kitchen, and crashed through it. Next, I heard drawers and cabinets being ripped open and objects spilling on the floor. That was followed by the sound of frantic, wet chewing. I got up and stumbled to the doorway of the kitchen. She was crouched in the middle of the kitchen floor. She had pulled out every scrap of food she could find. There were shreds of bread, bread bags, chips, and a sundered box of donuts spread out on the floor all around her. She heard me and stopped gorging for a moment. She turned and looked up at me over her shoulder. The black goo had stopped flowing from her eyes. It had left massive streaks down her face like mascara. Beneath that, beneath all of my blood coating her face and her dress, beneath the skinned knees and skinned elbow, beneath the bread crusts and donut crumbs coating her full lips and now very human teeth, I saw a young woman with hazel eyes in the bloom of her early 20s. Full reset, Ben, I thought. You beautiful, brilliant bastard. Blood was still leaking between my fingers where I held my good hand compressing the wound on my neck. I was starting to lose the feeling in my hands and feet. Beginning to panic, barely able to use my injured right hand, I snatched the receiver off the rotary phone that hung on the wall. My bloodied, disfigured hand gripped the phone and shook badly as I tried to use my pinky finger to turn the dial. I stopped. Then I tore the receiver loose from the phone. Then I ripped out the cord connecting the phone to its outlet. I used my elbow to smash the rest of the phone off of the wall. Still clutching the side of my neck, I wheeled around and stumbled back into the parlor. Getting down on my knees, I clawed around with my free hand in the dust and cobwebs that had collected near the baseboards. Filth caked the still bleeding stump where my index finger used to be, but I kept clawing until I found what I sought after. The third pill was still intact. I held it before me in my ruined, broken hand. It seemed to glow with a spectral green light. I could hear the girl in the kitchen, still chewing noisily. I placed the pill carefully in my shirt pocket. If I can just get this bleeding to stop, I'm going to be so fantastically stinking rich.
This is a funny one, because my firm was actually instrumental in having all of this shut down under the Invention Secrecy Act, back in the late 90s, before it all went public. Don't have much more information for this field report. I would need to ask someone more senior if they know where Egemian ended up, but Mr. Amherst is, to my knowledge, still in the family crypt. I suppose I should probably check, just to be sure.